Greetings and welcome to the first of four segments in this interview series with Sherry Van Dyke on the topic of DBT and bipolar. Sherry Van Dyke is a prominent psychotherapist with a private practice in Ontario, Canada. Sherry is also a prolific writer who has published extensively on the topics of both DBT and bipolar, including the DBT Therapy Skills Workbook for Bipolar Disorder. In the first section of this interview, Sherry explains the unique challenges of teaching mindfulness to this population, with specific recommendations to address these challenges. For example, Sherry explores the difference between formal versus informal mindfulness, the importance of emphasizing informal practice with smaller blocks of time, as well as the importance of teaching clients to hone their mindfulness skills before they have entered either a manic or depressive state. Good afternoon, Sherry.
Thank you, Kirby,
so much for taking time to join us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No, it's completely our pleasure. For the sake of our listeners, I did want to just briefly introduce you. So Sherry is a very prominent psychotherapist with a private practice in the Ontario area. She's also a prolific author. So I don't mean to put you on the spot too much, Sherry, but I would like to just mention some of the books you've written. DBT Made Simple, Calming the Emotional Storm, Bipolar Workbook for Teens, Don't Let Your Emotions Run Your Life, DBT Therapy Skills Workbook for Bipolar, Relationship Skills 101 for Teens, and Surviving the Emotional Roller Coaster. That's pretty impressive.
Thanks.
Just curious, what was your favorite book to write?
Oh, gosh. I enjoyed all of them, but probably the DBT Skills for Bipolar Disorder.
Oh.
Maybe partly because it was my first, and so it was just exciting. But I have such passion about the work that I do with folks with bipolar disorder, and I just really enjoy it. So probably that part as well.
No, that's great, because I'll be honest, I don't work a ton with bipolar. Mm. So I'm actually really interested in hearing your thoughts, because this is material I would love to learn a lot more about.
Awesome.
How did you become introduced to DBT in the first place?
The way I like to put this is I have grown up in my career in DBT. So I was fortunate enough when I was doing my master's degree in social work, I ended up in a placement where we were just starting to get involved in a partnership. So I was working in the placement at a community hospital, and the clinic in the hospital that I was doing my placement with was just getting involved with community agencies to start up a DBT-informed program. So not a pure DBT program, but using DBT skills, we were doing group and individual work. And so that was my introduction to DBT. Prior to that, I had been working from a CBT perspective. And for me, the difference between DBT and CBT was just really profound. And DBT made a whole lot more sense to me. Not that CBT doesn't, and of course DBT is a type of cognitive behavior therapy, but I just really loved how generalizable DBT was, where I can teach somebody one skill that they can use in all sorts of different ways rather than having to be more, I want to use the word rigid with CBT, but I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just the scope of the skills in DBT are much broader, I find. So that was really my first introduction to DBT, and I just fell in love with it and I stuck with it. And that led me to where I am now.
Yeah, I can actually relate to that journey a lot myself. How did you become so enamored with the bipolar population?
So I've had people ask me that question before, and unfortunately, it's a little bit of a boring answer. There was never really, it was more accidental. I think of it as the universe guiding my path. But honestly, from day one, working at my placement at the hospital, where I subsequently ended up being hired on as a full-time therapist, by the way, but I was seeing clients on the waiting list with bipolar disorder. In Ontario, we have OHIP-funded services. People don't pay for services when they were coming into the hospital to see us, which is wonderful, but that means that we could end up with a 9-month waiting list. And so looking at our waiting list, I would see clients with bipolar disorder over and over again on the waiting list. And we didn't have any groups running for these folks. And so they would end up waiting longer than the person with depression and anxiety. And so part of it came from that, just seeing the suffering. And I would even go so far as to say seeing the additional suffering for folks with bipolar disorder because of the instability they often face with that diagnosis. So seeing that additional suffering and seeing how long they were waiting for services, But then also as I started to work with that population, I like your word enamored. I became more enamored with the diagnosis and doing the work with those folks because it was even more challenging where you sometimes didn't know who was walking in the door that day. Is it Catherine with depression? Is it Catherine with anxiety? Is it Catherine in a hypomanic episode? So I really liked that aspect of it, that it really kept me on my toes and was really challenging. But again, coming back to that suffering and seeing how much DBT and treatment, individual as well as group, could really be helpful for these folks.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. The mental health field is certainly very fortunate to have you to serve that population.
Oh, thank you, Kirby.
I just recently came across a statistic that approximately 1% of Canadians aged 15 years and older report symptoms that meet criteria for bipolar mm-hmm. in the previous 12 months. So that's pretty significant. And approximately yeah. 1 in 50 adults, so this is ages 25 and up, reported symptoms of bipolar at some point in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. It's a relatively significant part of the population, but mm-hmm. like you mentioned, there's not a ton of treatment services available.
Yeah. And the treatment services that are available, obviously we've got specialized services in hospitals and those kinds of things, but we have a lot of support groups. We have a lot of other places that people can look for support and not necessarily treatment, but get support. But there's even a real shortage of that for people with bipolar disorder. I remember working with various clients over the years who had bipolar who tried out a mood disorder support program or support for depression support groups. And it was always so interesting and heartbreaking because there was often a lot of invalidation that would happen in those kinds of support groups. And what I came to learn in working with bipolar disorder is that it's really like having apples being compared to oranges. So you put a person with bipolar disorder into a support group for depression. First of all, they're probably one of the only people there with bipolar disorder. And then second of all, the lack of understanding of bipolar disorder is still really prolific, I think, for lay people. So if I'm in a support group for depression and I meet somebody with bipolar disorder, one of the things I hear quite often is, oh, wow, you're so lucky that you get those high episodes. Like, I would love to have hypomanic episodes.
Yeah.
And that is so invalidating for the client with bipolar disorder, where you have no idea. There's such a black and white perspective still of what bipolar disorder feels like for people, and that it's in those high episodes or the elevated episodes, it's all good and fun and energizing. But people don't recognize the increase in suicidality, the agitation, like just the physical symptoms, never mind the psychic pain and the other issues that people deal with in those episodes. And that's the hypomania, not even looking at the manic episodes.
So you've already mentioned invalidation, you've mentioned mm-hmm. black and white. So you're already touching on all of these major themes that DBT uh-huh. addresses.
Yeah.
So I'd just like to follow up on something you mentioned. So you mentioned that really you don't even know who is going to show up
right.
in the office, even if it's the same person.
Yeah.
So how in the world do you even teach mindfulness when you don't even know exactly what is going to show up?
Mm-hmm. For me, that's never been too much of a struggle because in my DBT work, my focus has always been not on borderline personality disorder, but on emotion dysregulation. And that's, I think, what led me really to look at applying DBT to this population. And so when I think about anybody with emotion dysregulation, we never really know where they're going to be. Now, of course, with bipolar disorder, you think about somebody coming in with a hypomanic episode or somebody who is in a severe depression. But even a client without bipolar disorder, a severe depression could mean that they're really not able to do a 15-minute, a 30-minute mindfulness practice, never mind a 5-minute mindfulness practice. When I'm teaching people with bipolar disorder mindfulness, I like to go, first of all, as with any good psychotherapy, it's client-centered. So I like to look at where my client is at. What kind of episode have they been in recently and where are they at today? What's their capacity right in this moment? Because they might be in a euthymic, a stable episode a stable mood episode right now. And yet maybe something fairly distressing has just happened. And so they're really still not able to do a challenging, explain what I mean by that, but a challenging mindfulness practice. So a practice, for example, where we're focusing on having them observing their thoughts for 5 minutes. To me, that's a really challenging practice. Okay, so to go back to your question, how do I teach mindfulness to this population? An individual, I'm looking at making this client-centered. How much experience does this client have already with mindfulness? Because quite often, As you know, Kirby, I'm sure, we have more and more people coming into our offices who are already practicing mindfulness or who have already at least had some kind of exposure to mindfulness. So what are they doing already? What's their understanding of it? If I have somebody come in who is already practicing 10-minute formal exercises every day, then I actually might want them to be practicing more informal exercises. So I really like to help them find a balanced way of practice. I know we have so much data and research on how helpful formal, the meditative is what I mean by that, the meditation, mindfulness meditation is what I refer to as the formal practices. We have so much data on how helpful that is for various mental health problems. But what people often don't understand is that we also need them practicing in informal ways. It's not just about sitting for half an hour every day. It's also about being more aware of, for example, what's going on in your body. Are your thoughts starting to get more racy? Are you feeling that little bit of agitation? And so it's not just about looking at those things for half an hour every day. It's on an ongoing basis doing those check-ins. And that is so important, especially for people with bipolar disorder, because quite often we're going to get some very important information from those daily informal mindfulness practices that they're doing. So I like people to start off with short practices, especially again, if they're new to mindfulness, if they're struggling with some kind of episode, it's going to be more doable for them. So when I say short, like maximum of 2 minutes. And I always start people off not with formal practices, but with informal. Drive to your appointment mindfully. So if you live 5 minutes away, maybe even do just 2 minutes of your drive into my office mindfully. You have to check your email at work every day. Check your first email of the day mindfully. Go for a walk mindfully or 2 minutes of your walk. Do that mindfully. Sit and pet your dog mindfully. Have a conversation with your partner mindfully. So that's really how I start people off. And then we just go from there depending on what their needs are, what they're doing already, how. Some people never get to the point of wanting to do formal practices, and I don't insist on that. I like to educate and provide the information about how formal practices can be helpful. But as long as my client is doing something mindfully, then that's all I'm after. So I think dialectically about mindfulness, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Wow, that was so fascinating. Your whole distinction between formal versus informal, not to mention validating, to use a DBT term, because that is exactly when I do DBT trainings, I make the same distinction. And when I teach DBT to clients, I also emphasize the informal.
Awesome. Just
in the same way you did.
Yes.
So for example, if there's certain things you have to do, wash your laundry or wash the dishes or cut the grass, or whatever, why don't you just take at least a couple minutes and apply mindfulness?
Exactly.
And if you do that throughout the day, that's the whole point of mindfulness anyway.
Yeah.
What's the point of the best formal practice if it doesn't somehow very directly, practically translate into your daily life? So
yeah.
I share a very similar philosophy.
Awesome.
Does mindfulness practice look different if the client is in a manic state versus a depressive state?
So I typically clarify with my clients that probably if they are full-blown manic, they are not in a mindset where they're going to be able to practice mindfulness. But again, I don't want to be absolute. I don't want to be non-dialectical about that. That's been my experience, that usually I don't think I've yet met a client who in a full-blown mania was able to practice mindfulness. But there's always exceptions. When I have a client in a hypomanic episode, that's when it's going to be more challenging, but definitely it's certainly possible for them to practice mindfulness at that point. And I've actually had a lot of feedback from clients over the years that when they are in or getting into a hypomanic episode and they're able to practice mindfulness, it really helps to reduce the feelings of being overwhelmed at times when they're taking on multiple projects all at once and the thoughts start racing. It often helps to calm them. It helps them to take a step back to see what's more from their wise mind, what's actually going on right now, and to help them think a little bit more, again, from that internal wisdom about what they can do to help themselves. So definitely in a hypomanic episode, I would say mindfulness is helpful. Manic, usually I would say people are probably too unwell at that point to really effectively practice. Not to say it's impossible, but unlikely, I would say.
Okay. How about for a depressive state?
Oh, depression's absolutely. Again, more challenging, especially the more severe the depression, the harder it's going to be to practice. But this is also why, like any skill in DBT, we're focusing on practice, 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 and especially when you can practice outside of distressing situations. So the best time, and this is unfortunate because clients tend to come to us when they're not feeling well, but the best time for them to be practicing skills is when they are feeling well. So that's going to make it more accessible. But yes, it's definitely doable. It's just going to be more challenging in a depression. And then again, I want to usually make it more engaging is the word I'm looking for. When a client is in a deep depressive episode, a severe depression, that's not usually the time when I want them to be doing a 15-minute observing your thoughts kind of exercise.
Sure.
So yeah, how about you go for a walk mindfully, focusing on body sensations, on self-soothing kinds of things. So incorporating mindfulness with other skills to help potentially improve the mood, I find is what helps best.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, what you were just saying also applies very well to the DBT concept of coping ahead.
In
other words, don't wait until you're in a manic state or a depressive state.
Exactly.
To practice mindfulness, do that ahead of time.
Yeah.
And I also really like the distinction you made between ability to comply with treatment. A lot of times, people assume that a manic state is great, like you mentioned before, and that who wouldn't want to be manic? And really, that's when patients tend to be less able to comply with treatment.
Yeah, for sure. And part of that is the illness kind of fooling them into thinking that everything is okay, the lack of insight, but it's also inability. It's like their thinking goes offline. So they struggle to concentrate. They struggle to remember. It's emotion dysregulation is what it comes back to. And when we get that dysregulated, the thinking shuts down.
Sure. And it's a different type of emotion dysregulation than we normally think of when we think of applying DBT concepts. Because like you mentioned earlier, we normally think of applying DBT to borderline. Mm-hmm. And so we normally think of emotion dysregulation as primarily dysphoric. Mm-hmm. But euphoric states can also be states of emotional dysregulation, like you
mentioned. Absolutely.
There are three main points from this section. First, when working with bipolar symptoms, it is helpful to emphasize informal mindfulness practice over formal mindfulness practice. In other words, practical daily application versus traditional meditation. Second, when working with bipolar symptoms, it is helpful to teach clients to practice their mindfulness in much smaller blocks of time than with other clients. For example, just a few minutes of mindfulness practice at a time sprinkled throughout the day, as opposed to one large block of time on a daily basis. And third, when working with bipolar symptoms, it is helpful for clients to practice coping ahead by honing their mindfulness skills when they are relatively stable in between poles. In other words, before they are actively immersed in either a manic or depressive state.